I want to spend most of my time in Mark chapter 7 today, so probably want to just go ahead and turn there. We'll take a look at that, have some things to consider as we think about what Jesus is doing in this particular incident. Many prophets before Jesus have pointed out the false piety of those who worship God with their lips, but whose hearts are far from Him. So much of the New Testament, or so much of what Jesus says, has the intention of bringing our hearts close to Jesus, and not just what we say. And after our long discussion this morning about taming the tongue, it becomes very apparent that the tongue can say a lot of things, but it's what the heart reveals in the tongue that's really what's important. Many of these people that prophets point out really show their disobedience. They just demonstrate in their lives their real disobedience. Jesus himself says, by their works you will know them. So in other words, don't listen to just what people say. Watch what they do. Jeremiah 7, verses 9 through 10. We have been studying Jeremiah on Wednesday nights. We just got through with this particular passage, but I think part of this is worth repeating because it's so relevant here to what Jesus is saying. Jeremiah says, behold, you trust in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods you have not known, and then come before me and stand here in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, only to go on doing all these abominations? There was a lot of worship going on in Jeremiah's time. They had the temple. It's very possible that he had been living through the time of Josiah when the temple worship had been restored. But he still looks at him and he says, guys, just restoring the worship is not good enough. Because if you're going to go out and do whatever you want after you come here to worship, it's like, don't bother. Because it really is worthless religion. Jesus encounters the same people in his own day who have shrouded their piety in a lot of man-made religious gestures, but whose lives really do not reflect the obedience necessary to God's laws. And it's easy to look religious. It's easy to do a lot of religious things or go through a lot of ritual. It's another thing entirely to obey the commands of God. We need to do both because they both are important. But let's see what Jesus says there. Let's see how he addresses the problems that he sees showing up in his own day. The problem here is one of washing of hands and not washing of hearts, apparently. Okay? They had taken the idea of washing to a level of religious cleansing. That's how they understood it. Jesus' disciples, in verse 2, we are told, are eating with unwashed hands. You know, it's like they sat down to the dinner table and mom never said to them, go wash your hands. Now, they didn't care. They just sat and they ate. And the Pharisees looked at that as an irreligious activity. It wasn't just a matter of cleanliness as to what we would say today. And there's a lot we think about today about hygiene and so forth. But the Pharisees looked at this as a religious duty. And Mark explains some other things, what they do. Now, it's interesting that Mark has to explain it. Some of your translations may put it in parentheses. It's kind of like a little aside. Or if you know you're reading an article in a paper and you have a little sidebar that explains a little more of something else, well, that's what Mark is doing. And he's probably doing that because his audience is probably mostly Gentiles, or at least has a Gentile audience, the one he's writing to, by the way, okay? He's writing to people who are Gentiles. So he has to explain, well, here's why Jesus is upset with this. Here's what the Pharisees have done. And he says they don't eat unless they do all this stuff. You know, they wash cups, they wash pots and vessels and dining couches. You know, it would be probably something similar today to us taking a little, you know, those little hand towels, you know, and just washing off the chairs. And considering it a religious duty to do so. We're not even talking about hygiene here. We're talking about religious duty. And it says they don't eat unless they wash. And the word is interesting here because the word can also be translated as baptize or purify themselves. And, you know, the Old Testament has a lot of ceremonies involving ritual cleansings. They were to cleanse themselves from bodily discharges. Priestly washings before they went into the sacrifice had to be done. They had to cleanse themselves with water after they touch a dead body, after a funeral situation. So there were all kinds of things that you sort of understand where they got this from. That cleansing with water was really important. But they had elevated it to a level that was, they had missed a lot of other things. And there were a lot of things they were cleansing that were not required in the Old Testament. For the Pharisees, this became a religious rite that had to be followed in order to remain pure, ritually pure. And Jesus takes issue with it here because, in essence, he's really taking issue with what causes one to be impure in the eyes of God. And in verses 14 through 23, which we're not going to deal with this morning, that's where he really explains all that. You know, this idea of washing off the defilement of the body to sort of represent spiritual purity or to bring one into spiritual purity was so foreign to what Jesus is trying to say here. He says defilement comes else from something else. As we talked about the tongue this morning, it's really a heart issue. And Jesus, if he is doing anything, he is trying to get us to think about our hearts and where our hearts are at. And so Jesus says to them, you know what? You honor me with your lips, but your hearts are far from me. These washings, they have no spiritual value. They do nothing to heal or to harm our relationship with God. And again, set aside the whole hygiene thing now, because I think it's important. This kind of thing for hygiene is important. But not spiritual hygiene. It is absolutely unnecessary for spiritual hygiene. It diverts us from the real issue. And Jesus accuses them of being far from God. They only pay him lip service. That's all these things are doing. They ignore the real issues involved in one's religious life. And his accusation is quite in line with Jeremiah and other prophets. In fact, he's quoting here from Isaiah chapter 29 and verse 13. So the heart becomes the essence of the issue. Now, what Jesus also does here, he says, all right, let's take this a step further. And it's almost like Mark is trying to say, all right, let's give some real background here as to why this is important and perhaps what the Pharisees do in other cases. He says, Jesus goes on to say, and he sort of illustrates, as to the fifth commandment, he says, honor your father and mother, or in their understanding, it also meant not only to obey them, but to provide for them in their old age. He says, as to the fifth commandment, you don't even bother with that. You've ignored it, and here's how you do it. But let's note, first of all, before we even get into that, that the New Testament itself also tells children to obey your parents in everything. Colossians chapter 3 and verse 20. This Old Testament law is not set aside because we're in the New Testament. It still is an essence of who we are as a community, as a people, as family members. It is important that we show the proper honor to those who came before us, in particular, our parents. Now, what the Jews had done here is they'd established this law or this tradition, and it was called Korban, which is actually a variation of the word sacrifice in the Old Testament. But here, it became money that you could set aside for religious purposes. In other words, you could say this money is now holy and dedicated to the Lord. And so it wasn't, therefore, couldn't be used for anything other than some religious purpose. It was considered an offering to God. And you know, that sounds like a pretty good impulse, doesn't it? We take up an offering. And we want people to give because God expects us to give of ourselves, of our means, and of our time, and all kinds of things. So the impulse sounds pretty good. We're dedicating money that God's going to get. Something dedicated was now meant for religious purposes and could not be used for non-religious purposes. So the religious impulse, once again, is very good. The problem here is several fold. First of all, honoring parents was also a religious impulse. I mean, it was embedded within the very commandments, the first 10 of all of the law. It was the fifth commandment, honor your mother and father. And so, in terms of religious impulses, this was a pretty big one. Not to mention that probably what they were doing here was sort of hiding the money. We think that's probably what was going on. We think that was the purpose of this. It wasn't just they really had this strong religious impulse. They would sort of say it was dedicated to God and then didn't have to use it for supposedly non-religious purposes, meaning supporting their parents. And maybe when the parents died, they could say, okay, well, now I got the money back. So the impulse may have sounded good at first, but there was some cheating going on behind it. You know, they weren't really using the money for religious purposes. And maybe the Pharisees and the people who made this law, they thought, well, we'll get the money. So maybe that was part of what was going on there. It would be given somehow to the temple or somehow to God in some way. But even in the New Testament, elsewhere in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul connects our faith with our parental obligation. Listen to what he says in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8. And you tell me if you think Paul is not serious about this. He says, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. I think the Apostle Paul is pretty serious about taking care of your own family, isn't he? In fact, he will go on to say in this long discussion about, you know, widows and whether or not they should be supported by the church, he says down in verse 16, if any believing widow has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened so that it may care for those who are really widows. You know, save the community treasury for those who really need it. The first line of care belongs in the family, belongs with members of a family. And that's where the Apostle Paul, and Paul says that is a religious duty. It's as religious as any sacrifice or offering you can offer up to God. It's what is expected of you. We need also remember the Good Samaritan took his religious life to the highways and the byways of the world. He knew that loving your neighbor meant really loving your neighbor and doing kindnesses for them and caring for them and having compassion upon them. Jesus says, you've taken this law of Korban and you have allowed people to disobey the fifth commandment. And you've made it into a religious issue, almost a religious duty that allows you not to obey the fifth commandment. And that's exactly what he's upset about. They're using a religious impulse to say, I don't have to take care of my parents. And basically he says, and many such things you do. You know, I kind of like to have the list. You know, what other things is he talking about? This is a great rationalization here that they've allowed themselves to get away with it. Well, you know, there's some application here for today, as is there is in all of the New Testament. And there's a kind of separation that we make today for ourselves sometimes as well as for other people. And that separation is really our hearts from God. You know, I seem to never tire of saying that the Pharisees are the people in the New Testament we love to hate. You know, and we see them in the embodiment of all that is evil and all that is, you know, false piety. And maybe forget that, you know, it's easy to fall into the same traps the Pharisees fell into. You know, this impulse for purity that they ended up washing their hands over was kind of a good impulse in a way, even if they misunderstood what the impulse was, what the real impurity was, which is the issue here. But they had the impulse. They had the desire to do the right thing. They had the desire for purity. They just went off on a tangent somewhere. And I think we need to be careful that our desires don't do the same thing and go off on a tangent somehow. One of the ways I see this being applied by society in general is to try to keep religion out of everyday life, which is kind of what these people are doing here, isn't it? They kept religion out of the practical side of life, taking care of your family. See, I believe the duty to love God and neighbor has societal and cultural consequences. What we do, what we believe, has to be acted upon in a context of the community of people, both our community within these walls and our community without the walls as well. And there's a lot of impulse today to try to keep faith to be only a private matter. You may have even heard people talk about this. They don't want it to be something that bears directly on society's important moral issues. And probably one of the best illustrations I can use for that, and not just to pick on this individual, but it stands out so much. Former Governor Mario Cuomo, not the governor today, his father, okay? He had a very interesting position on abortion. And it's kind of the classic example of trying to get religion out of the public square in a way. Though he was a Catholic and admitted he knew that Catholicism condemned abortion, did not support it at all, he said, as a public official, I can support abortion even though my religious life is against it. And of course, all the people who believe in abortion and people on a certain political spectrum, you know, thought that was wonderful, thought it was brilliant, thought it was enlightened that he could separate himself from his religious life and keep that as a private matter. Now, I don't know if that's exactly what the Pharisees were doing here, but it sure does separate the heart from the religious impulse, from the religious life. It certainly draws this huge gap. I can believe whatever I want, just don't let it make a difference in the way I live. And that's essentially how we do, I think, the same thing. We honor God with our lips, but our hearts end up being very far from Him. Now, that's just an example. There are plenty of other ways that we do this, but here is a way of maintaining this religious veneer without caring about, basically, the murder of innocent lives. That's pretty powerful when you think about it. But essentially, I think it's kind of what the Pharisees were doing, kind of separating out certain things and saying, you don't have to do this. We've done this kind of similar thing with our sexual mores as well. I don't want to give a lot of undue attention to the issue of homosexuality. We've had a lot of discussions about that on numerous times, you know, how it's, you really can't justify the practice of it with Christian teachings, or even within the natural order of relationships. It just doesn't make sense. Even without the religious component, it just doesn't fit. But what happens is many people will kind of put a veneer over this of, it's a matter of justice or a matter of love. We have to love those people as well. And we kind of divorce it from this whole notion of, you know, there still needs to be some obedience to the sexual issues involved in biblical morality. So it becomes a matter of, we have to love them. And we ignore the part of, you know, the fact is there's a sin going on here that's pretty vile and we need to stop. We can't do that. And we do something similar with the whole issue of premarital sex, with the whole issue of marriage, you know. We seek to redefine marriage so that we don't really have to be obedient to what marriage really is. And, you know, there's a lot of ways that perhaps we try to maintain our belief in Christ or our belief in God. And probably the separation kind of occurs because a lot of people will say, well, I'm still a good person. You know, that's probably the biggest way the separation occurs today. We put this veneer, well, I'm really a good person. And then we turn around and we do all these other things. You know, and I'm sorry, but if you do all those other things, you're not a good person. You're a good person in some ways, and most people on the outside, they're pretty good. You know, we maintain a certain civility, you know, in our relationships. When we go into the store, we expect people to behave with kindness or with a certain civility and say the right things and not just get out of line. But when we take this, I'm a good person, and sort of ignore all these other things, we're doing essentially what the Pharisees did. We're separating our hearts from our lips. And we are not serving God, essentially, when we do that kind of thing. You know, at least the prostitutes in Jesus' day, they knew they weren't living right. They admitted it. Matthew 21, verses 31 through 32, Jesus talks about the tax collectors and the prostitutes. They said, you know, they believed John. They knew they weren't living right when they heard John's preaching and when they encountered Jesus. They knew it. They knew there was something wrong. They weren't unwilling to admit it. They weren't unwilling to make this separation between the heart and the behavior. They just knew that separation was not legitimate. Anytime I think that we separate our behavior from obedience, no matter what religious practices we engage in, we have done essentially what the Pharisees have done. We've come up with a substitute religion. Our worship, our Bible studies, are intensely influential. We come here and we worship so that we can remember how we're supposed to live, and so that we can take God with us every day in our lives and try to apply it. Even if we apply it imperfectly, we're at least making the attempt. That's what it's all about. What we do here must reflect in the way we live outside of here. And we cannot make substitutions to make ourselves feel religious. We can't go through the rituals and walk out and do whatever we want. I think we all know that. But why is it so many of these Pharisees didn't, and so many other people just sort of make that separation so easily? Maybe it's easier. I don't always know the reason. You know, maybe the demands are so serious, and the purity and the holiness that God calls us to be is so difficult, which I don't think it is, but, you know, there are just some things about us we kind of don't want to change. It's easier to have the substitute, you know? It's easier to look for quick solutions to things when there perhaps are no quick solutions. My exhortation today is simple. Don't worship with your lips only. Certainly is one of the pitfalls James implies. You know, our mouths can get out of hand. Talk is cheap, and actions speak louder than words. The gospel does indeed demand obedience. Listen to what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Speech. But the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Action. Speech and action. They go together. Don't let your religious duties keep you from practicing the real thing, which is obedience to God's command. We believe in the gospel. It is the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of sins. We urge you today to not only accept that, but to live it. Stand and sing.